The dollar went down and the president's sick. Who's in charge now? I don't know, take your pick. A new disease every day and the old ones are coming back. Things are looking kind of gray, like they're gonna get black. Don't turn on the TV, don't show me the paper. Don't wanna know he got kidnapped or why they all raped her. I wanna go on vacation till the pressure lets up. But they keep hijacking airplanes and blowing them up. It's been a hard day on the planet. How much is it all worth? It's getting harder to understand it. Things are tough all over on Earth. It's hot in December, cold in July. When it rains, it pours out of a poisonous sky. In California, the body counts keep getting higher. It's evil out there, man, that state is always on fire. Everyone has a system, but they can't seem to win. Even Bob Geldof looks alarmingly thin. I got to get on that shuttle, get me out of this place. But there's gonna be warfare up there in outer space. It's been a hard day on the planet. How much is it all worth? It's getting harder to understand it. Things are tough all over on Earth.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
Power to the people.
KBOO's Board of Directors is delighted to invite all KBOO members to the annual membership meeting and Board of Directors elections. The meeting will be held on Saturday, September 17th at 1 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street, Portland. A Zoom link and call-in access will be provided to those who are unable to attend in person. This is the opportunity for all members to meet the candidates, get station updates, and make their voices heard. Again, that's KBOO's annual membership meeting and Board of Directors elections, Saturday, September 17th at 1 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm/meeting2022.
Pacifica Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, North Dakota State Senator Ruth Ann Buffalo helped celebrate the call to release and free Leonard Peltier. Also, the grassroots campaign to free Peltier turns up the heat. We'll speak to an AIM representative about that. And also, millions of Pakistanis face deadly torrential flooding. And also, the battle for solar heats up in California. All this and more coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And and you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We come to you every weekday from 5 to 6 over the Pacifica Radio Network. We are live today in San Francisco and Los Angeles, and we are happy to have you along. And we are really delighted to welcome to these airwaves North Dakota State Senator Ruth Buffalo. State Senator Buffalo has been engaged in trying to free what many thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of people consider a political prisoner. We're talking about Leonard Peltier. And, well, you may have heard the Democratic National Committee on Saturday voted unanimously to pass a resolution urging the president to release activist Leonard Peltier from prison. And there is a growing momentum to release him. We're going to talk about that now, and we're going to begin. Happy to have you with us, State Senator Ruth Anna Buffalo. Well, tell us, for you, what's at the heart of the matter? You've been very concerned. You've been fighting this battle for some time. Why is it important to you that Leonard Peltier be released? He's been in jail so long.
Yes. First of all, thank you for having me. I'm also a state house rep for District 27 in Fargo, North Dakota. This is so important to all of us because I see my relatives in Leonard. I see all of us in Leonard, and he represents all of us in the struggle for justice in our country as Indigenous peoples, being the first peoples, the original inhabitants of these lands. We are still seeking justice, and until Leonard's free, we all will be free.
Now, he has served a lot of time in jail. According to a fairly recent report from the United Nations, they looked at the case and they saw the kind of corruption that they called for Leonard Peltier to be released immediately. You want to talk a little bit about, just maybe remind people, some of the corruption and why this is so significant in terms of thinking about releasing him and why he should be vindicated and exonerated?
Sure. I also want to note, you know, I've been helping sort of behind the scenes with trying to get Leonard released since about a year ago in October. So I'm fairly new, and I just also really want to commend those who have been there from the very beginning when he first went into prison. You know, Jean Roach from Pine Ridge has been very instrumental in advocating for his release. And so we know that his case is completely unjust. There were constitutional violations, due process, and also the false testimony of witnesses, false statements, even from when he was extradited from Canada, based on false statements of an alleged eyewitness who later retracted their statement. There's many evidentiary and procedural irregularities that arose during Mr. Peltier's prosecution, again, such as alleged key witnesses to the shootings later retracting their statements, disclosing threats that were put out against them and eyewitnesses and the family by the FBI. So there's a lot there.
Why do you think, after all these years, and all the, some of the information you're talking about, well, why would they be so afraid of somebody like Leonard Peltier? Does it have something to do with the power and the relationship he has with his own people as a leader, and that perhaps the United States government is still afraid of him?
Well, I think, you know, being very new to, you know, this to the Leonard Peltier movement myself, as an outsider looking in, it's clear to see that he's being made an example out of. And so it's really heartbreaking and sad because of the longevity of his time spent. He's been in there for, what, 46 years? You know, today is his birthday. He is now 78 years old and in very poor health. We just need to keep pushing and advocating for him on all levels, in every level of government, I'm the vice chair of the National State Caucus of National Caucus of Native American State Legislators, and so we also issued a letter after he contracted COVID this past winter, and then prior to that, we issued another resolution urging Biden to issue clemency for Mr. Peltier. So we know many others out there are helping, and we're also getting more support from north of the Medicine Line in Canada. So globally, he has support. Many of the people who supported him globally, a lot of the human rights champions have since passed away. So that kind of gives you an idea of how long he's been in there. I have a 19-year-old daughter who learned about his case through our advocacy and is pushing me to continue to push harder. So the next generation is definitely watching.
You know, there have been some extraordinary revelations about the kinds of abuses that the indigenous communities have faced in North America. And the revelations almost continue nonstop. I'm wondering if this should not be considered a part of the that reconciliation, and that this would certainly be a good beginning. But it also appears, one gets the feeling that while a lot has changed, there is an indigenous member of the cabinet as the Interior Secretary, so much stays the same. And the federal government, the U.S. government, is still willing to side with corporations to suppress, repress, undermine, steal Indian land resources. Is this part of that big struggle?
Definitely. I mean, we know that our Native American relatives are overrepresented. We are over-incarcerated in every level of government criminal justice system, from county, city, state prisons, county jails, city jails, state prisons, federal prison. We are overrepresented. Leonard is a boarding school survivor. So much of what we are dealing with as everyday people, as indigenous people, indigenous, you know, original inhabitants, first peoples of this continent, what is now called, or, you know, the United States, we are still at the bottom of the barrel, so to speak, in terms of justice.
Yeah. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We have the honor of talking with State Senator Ruth Ann Buffalo, and she is engaged with many in trying finally to free Leonard Peltier. As you say, he's 78 years old today, 46 years, I believe, in prison. How's his health?
Very poor. Right now. It's very, very bad health. You know, we know that he contracted COVID and thankfully survived it, but he is still in very poor health, has heart problems, just a plethora of health conditions. And so it is a very strong sense of urgency that we continue to push and ask President Biden for his release so that Leonard can spend the rest of his days within his homelands of the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa Indians in North Dakota.
Has there been an appeal, any support from the Interior Secretary, who, after all, I believe I saw her cooking at Standing Rock?
Right. Definitely know that she is a supporter of Leonard Peltier, but we haven't heard anything further from her office.
Okay, well, maybe she's waiting for the right moment, which probably would be right around now. Is there anything that you want to share? What would you tell her if you were looking eye to eye at her right now and had a chance to tell her what you thought, why it would be important? If you had a minute or two to tell her that, what would you say?
Oh, that's a very, very loaded question there, but I would say to our relative and our leader and role model, Secretary Deb Haaland, that first, we love you, and we understand you're in a very, very big role and in a tough position, but you know, with Leonard's release, only then can true healing happen and occur within our country, our nation.
Wow. Well, listen, we really appreciate the time you took out to speak with us on Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We hope that you'll keep us posted, and we want to know more about the good work we're sure you're doing there in North Dakota and in Fargo and those parts. Thank you for taking the time out, and please stay safe.
Thank you. You too. Mazagadad.
Okay. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to take a short break, and we're going to talk with our good friend Tony Gonzalez, who works with AIM West and has been engaged in this battle to free Leonard Peltier for some time. So stay with us. Joining us from some undisclosed location in the west coast of San Francisco is our good friend, our good brother, Tony Gonzalez of the AIM West, American Indian Movement West. Well, it's his 78th birthday, Tony Gonzalez, 46 years behind bars. We've got an indigenous Secretary of the Interior. Where is this battle?
Oh, thank you, Dennis Bernstick and my good friend Miguel Molina, you know, for this time, and having heard the state representative of North Dakota, State Senator Ruth Buffalo, speak, and she herself helped spearhead this resolution through the Democratic National Committee. And we're talking here now, Dennis, 70 million voters, 70 million, over 70 million Democrats whom they represent are calling right now on President Biden to release him. And today being his birthday, 78 years old, it would be most fitting if all our friends, allies, supporters, and those that seek justice to give a gift to Leonard Peltier by calling the White House and leave a message to President Joe Biden to provide an immediate executive clemency, a compassionate release, or a COVID-19. He qualifies for all of those types of releases. So call the White House at 202-456-1111. 202-456-1111. And Dennis and Miguel, you know, there's a lot of movement right now for Leonard Peltier. In fact, here in San Francisco, February the 24th is Solidarity Day with Leonard Peltier. And it was proclaimed by the Board of Supervisors, and it was introduced by Supervisor Hillary Ronan, and then co-authored Gordon Marr, Peskin, and all the rest. It passed unanimously. And
there, what day is that?
February the 24th has been declared.
February the 24th. Well, we hope he's out in time to come there in person.
I hope, you know, it's announced today that he will be released. But in the meantime, there's an effort by the American Indian Movement right now underway, a walk for freedom for Leonard Peltier. from out of Minneapolis. They left September the 1st, and they're marching, they're walking 20 miles a day, 1,100 miles to arrive in Washington, D.C., November the 14th. And during this whole time, we're creating that attention. You know, we've had good friends that have been on this as well, networks and organizations, the Freedom Archives with Claude Marx, Gloria La Riva, Answer Coalition, and of course, Carol Robidoux, the auntie of Leonard Peltier, has always been with us in advancing his cause. So I think the momentum is really good. It can't be better. We have at least the Democrats we need right now, Dennis, in the Congress that can make a difference, that continue to make the difference. We don't know what's going to have to happen after midterm, but we have to keep that pressure on for the release of Leonard Peltier.
We're speaking with Tony Gonzalez of AIM West. Now, where did you say that walk was at the moment? Do you know where they are right now?
It's
a 1,100-mile walk.
They will be in Wisconsin, I believe, on September 17th from Minneapolis. They're walking 20 miles a day, and they will be in Wisconsin on September 17th. You can go to AI
Movement. Do you have their number? Are you talking to them while they're walking?
No, I'm saying, I'm giving the website where people can go to.
Okay, go on.
Website to see, and that's AIMovement.org. And there's a Facebook also, Freedom for Leonard Peltier Walk to Washington, D.C. So we have all these forces and elements at play. And our listeners devoted to KPFA as well know that where KPFA has been covering the extractive industries, the greed and the plundering, there has also been camps and protests and flags of American Indian Movement are flying at all of these camps, because that's the spirit of Leonard Peltier. He's doing time for all of us. And for a crime he did not commit. That's why we have to make this effort right now. People to remind it, Dennis and Miguel, Wounded Knee, 1973, after the Wounded Knee closed from 73 to 75, over 60 men and women were killed, murdered, assassinated, disappeared, and the FBI has not been held accountable for each and every one of those deaths. It's what we refer to as the reign of terror. You hear reign of terror when bombs are being dropped over cities and towns as a reign of terror. Well, it was a reign of terror and threat. It was that climate of the 60s and 70s that led to the shootout. And Gene Roach and Carol Gokey, among others, have been at the forefront to seek Leonard's release. Gene Roach herself was a 15-year-old girl there at the Jumping Bull compound in June of 75. And to this day, she continues to call for the freedom for Leonard Peltier. He did not do the crime. The feds know that. They're in this dirty business of holding people back, especially leadership and movement, people that assert. Well,
that's for sure. That's what there's a lot of talk about the noble FBI, but when it comes to being a Native American in America, but listen, Tony, we're just about out of time, and I want to give you this question. If you had a couple of minutes to talk to the Interior Secretary, who is now Native American, what would you say? Do you think she's responsible here in a position where she needs to act?
Oh, no, I believe she is doing her part. When she was here at Alcatraz last November and for the 50-year reunion, she stated that she's already given her position for Freedom for Leonard Peltier. She's a Democrat. She used to be the head of the Democratic Party in Nuevo Mexico for the Laguna Pueblo peoples and all the rest. So she's in this, the National Congress of American Indians, 570 federally recognized tribes are in support of his release. For the American Indian peoples of this land, Freedom for Leonard Peltier would be a step forward in the healing process and getting back to the serious business of living.
The serious business of living. Well, 78 years old, post-COVID, 46 years in prison for, as you say, essentially being indigenous in North America. That was the crime of the American Indian movement, and that's what happened, and it's continuing to happen. That battle continues. We will continue. Again, an address, a place if people want more information, if they want to stand with you, Anthony Gonzalez, if they want to stand with AIM, if they want to stand with that courageous state senator from North Dakota. The best way to communicate.
Yes, yes. Well, they can go to, people can go to AIM-WEST.org. And to get a real detail on Leonard Peltier, I have a TV show on Sundays called Eagle and Condor Public Access. You can go to that website, live stream, and we'll have a documentary, talks by Kevin Sharp, the attorney for Leonard, Carol Gokey, Gene Roach, Lenny Foster, and then we'll have a film about Leonard Peltier, the life of Leonard Peltier, called Warrior.
Beautiful. All right. Tony Gonzalez, as always, honored to have you on. The incredible work you do is appreciated by many listeners to this radio network. Thanks, Tony. Be safe.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to take a short break, and we're going to turn our attention to Pakistan. One-third of the population apparently is close to being underwater. This is a profoundly serious situation, and the United States is like interested in selling weapons packages wherever they can. More to come. Stay with us. Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We take it to Pakistan now, and we welcome back Professor Junaid Ahmad. And Professor, this program tends to sort of go right straight to the politics of stuff, but this is a profound situation. This is where a good chunk of the population of Pakistan are in grave jeopardy. You want to give us a sense of, as best as you understand it, what's going on in the ground and what the multiple dangers are?
Sure, Dennis, and thanks for having me again. Yes, you're absolutely right. Right now, this country has been subsumed by floods, as you mentioned. virtually a third of the country has been underwater. And, you know, this is becoming more and more frequent every year. We know why, because of climate change and because of the way that the Pakistani governments have had to focus on servicing debts, accumulated debts by their elites to the IMF and so on, rather than trying to do something to ameliorate the impact of these floods. But yeah, it's a terrible situation right here. And but this is part of the carbon footprint left by the Western powers, and particularly the United States and its military globally.
And this is the impact of global warming happening today and yesterday. This is people here in the United States often talk about global warming as something that's, you know, off in the distance a little bit, although the fires and the floods are coming here too, and nobody's immune. But right. It is happening, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yes. South Asia, as all the scientists are saying, is at the epicenter of the impact, the dramatic and horrible consequences of climate change. And, you know, we have seen this before in Bangladesh on a very massive scale. And now, year after year, we're seeing it in Pakistan as well, as because, you know, we have a lot of the glaciers here in the northwest of the country, and they are melting, and everything here is kind of lopsided at this point. And yes, it's all traced to climate change and global warming.
Now, and we have been speaking with you recently about the politics, what's been going on the ground, and sort of the subversion of the will of the majority, if you will, in your country. And I'm wondering if you think the sacking of a popular leader has made it much more difficult to deal with some of these problems. You think the situation is a lot worse because of the kinds of politics that the United States has really played a key role in terms of destabilization policies,
absolutely.
World Bank and the
absolutely. I think that yes, you're absolutely right to emphasize the World Bank and the IMF, and you know, the way the Pakistani government is routinely forced to beg for another loan to service another debt that they have. That is, right now there is a movement calling for cancellation of all debt in the middle of this massive crisis. And Imran Khan has been the most vocal proponent of such a thing. Imran Khan, again, being the ousted prime minister, who has now garnered massive popular support throughout the country. So yes, absolutely. This is related to the way that the government has always been hamstrung by the Western powers and their financial institutions to service debt and on the other hand pay for the defense industry, rather than actually focus on institutional and infrastructural mechanisms to mitigate the impact of such type of natural disasters.
And what is the situation with Khan now? There have been some pretty massive protests. There's been a lot of resistance. That's all happening in the middle of these floods. And where is he now?
Well, that's what's been remarkable. Of course, he's also been at the forefront of something that he is quite an expert in, and that's as a philanthropist, as a fundraiser, because we should know that before Khan became a politician, he was of course, first captain of the Pakistani cricket team, and then a major philanthropist during the 1990s, in which he helped establish the first free cancer hospital in all of Asia, perhaps in the world. So he's known for this, and he has generated the most amount of money on this cause. But the amazing thing, Dennis, I mean, some of us are just surprised at the guy's stamina, is that he continues to go from city to town almost on a daily basis, and with large crowds coming out. And, you know, it's still pretty hot here in Pakistan. So it's incredible that, the stamina of this man has, but also the fact that the momentum that was there right after he was ousted in early April remains as strong now, and some would say even stronger than at that point as well.
Who gained and how in terms of hurrying Amar Khan's departure? Why would the power structure in the United States, I guess along with the British Empire, that empire that not everybody loves, what would they gain? What's the deal there?
And they're, of course, comprador elites here in Pakistan. Yeah, I mean, well, you know, I think Dennis, we've gone over this.
I know you're gonna miss. I know you're gonna miss the Queen. I shouldn't say this.
Right. I think Khan was a hated individual by certainly the American national security state even before he came to power. We have spoken about in the past his vociferous critique of the American war on terror, particularly as it manifested in Afghanistan and in Pakistan, drone strikes and the like. He was consistent since 2001 in opposing that. And, you know, I don't think the American national security state ever forgave him for effectively being correct, that there is no military solution to what's going on in the region and that it only made the situation worse. So, on that front, he was hated before he even came to power in 2018. On top of it, the deepening of the relationship with China, the beginning of the improvement of relations with Russia, where unfortunately he landed there on the day of the Russian invasion into Ukraine, and so he was outrightly pressured by all Western governments to condemn Putin as he lands on Moscow airport, which he refused to do, and played the same neutrality card that America's close ally India did. He remained neutral on this question, but again, there are two other issues as well. One is his unequivocal support for Kashmiri liberation, and the second, perhaps the most important, is the one for Palestinian liberation. That was the one factor which I think angered not only Washington but all of Washington's allies in the Gulf, of course, Tel Aviv. All of these governments that had been pressuring Imran Khan throughout his period in power to improve and normalize relations with Israel, which much of the civilian and military elite in Pakistan actually were quite in favor of. However, Khan represented the voice of the people of Pakistan, who were absolutely against it. So there's so many reasons that the Western political establishment then used the entire power structure, virtually the entire power structure in Pakistan. We're talking about all the major political parties that normally despise each other, the military high command, the corrupt judiciary, the media, etc. Classic color revolution style regime change operation.
Professor Ahmad, can I ask you to, I sort of referenced the Queen and that whole operation, but will you talk just a little bit about your response in terms of colonial England? You can throw in and the Great Britain, you can throw in the United States if you want to. But when you see all that pomp and circumstance, what do you think about? I know you.
Yeah, no.
I mean, it's important to talk about because it covers the. It's like wall to wall carpeting on the corporate television networks.
Right, and our region knows the. The legacy of the Queen's Empire probably the best in the world, and it was an incredibly horrific legacy to say the least. And that legacy does not just mean the plundering and pillaging and the violence done during the heyday of colonialism, which went into the a brief period of when the Queen assumed the throne, but also its legacy and its impact today, that the Pakistani colonial bureaucracy and military still has not been able to decolonize itself. So while there was formal independence and the British flag went down in 47, the main vestiges of that colonial legacy have remained. And this is why, Dennis, what Imran Khan has represented after more than 70 years of formal independence of Pakistan, what he has represented is actually a meaningful, a genuine attempt to obtain some form of sovereignty, dignity, independence, autonomy, for the state of Pakistan. So I think that yes, when you think of the Queen passing away, we think of that old legacy, but we also think about the present as well, because those the vestiges of colonialism live with us today. You know, the center I direct, Center for the Study of Islam and Decoloniality, its purpose is to name this neo-colonial world order that we still exist in and that we need to free ourselves from.
Yeah, it is interesting when God comes into it and religion comes into it and becomes the excuse for whatever you need to do to a particular population. I grew up on Long Island in a very white Christian Long Island, and you know, every Ash Wednesday they came looking for me. So anyway, forgive me for that, but it is, you know, it is, you know, religion and colonialism go hand in hand, and all the prayers, the sterile prayers are a part of, you know, the underpinnings of the horrific suffering that still continues. However you want to scratch that surface, you know, it's sort of like the Catholic Church and, you know, the boarding schools and all this kind of stuff that was a part of colonialism,
and, you know,
right?
Dennis, that is the important point also here when we talk about religion, is actually the manipulation of these, you know, religions, if you call them religions, these historic wisdom, traditions, etc., all of the manipulation by the colonial powers of these, these traditions of these people, whether they call them religion, tradition, culture, or what have you. But it was the manipulation, it was the conquering and the conquer and divide policy, it was all sorts of imperial colonial impositions onto these traditions that have caused so many of the sectarian conflicts, say within the Muslim world. You know, we have such direct evidence of that, how colonial powers have played with that. So I think that we should still, at the end of the day, put the guilt on these players, these very secular players manipulating all of these forces, our traditions, yes, our wisdom traditions, and so on, for their own benefit.
Yes. I don't think in this country people understand really what a beautiful concept the separation of church and state is. But those people who believed that women had the right to choose are now understanding
Exactly, right.
The nature of the separation of church. You go on, please.
Right. I think the feminist majority that supported the American war in Afghanistan, thinking that it was liberating Afghan women, now have had to cope with the fact that these issues are not just issues that are in those backward third world brown countries, but also exist in the U.S. as well.
Right, and the American Taliban is strong and breathing fire, and everybody is scared now. And it will be, I must say, it will be the women, I'm sure, if we get saved, that are going to save us, because the dudes screwed up big time.
No doubt, undoubtedly.
But I can't, I'm sickened, but, you know, I mean, if, for instance, if you're Muslim or if you're Jewish, whatever, and you're listening to these ceremonies, these Christian ceremonies, you're out. You're not a part of it. You will not be welcomed into that heavenly place where everybody else is going.
Right.
It's a problem,
right.
Isn't it?
Right.
Forgive me. I'm going off. but listen, I really appreciate the information you bring us. Because people need to understand the kinds of impact that U.S. policy is having, particularly in Pakistan and now in the context of the floods. That's why I really did want to get back to you. Any final thought before we have to say goodbye?
All I wanted to say, Dennis, is that I wholeheartedly appreciate you constantly remembering Pakistan in a context in which either the Western media ignores it or utterly misrepresents what's going on in the country. And I salute you as one of the few people that I know that that consistently do a fabulous job in covering and giving us coverage.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I really appreciate it. And if people, you know, is there a place where you contribute regularly or if people want to follow the work you're doing?
Sure. Well, I contribute to Counterpunch, Consortium News, to the Gray Zone.
All the great places. Gray Zone, Counterpunch. Yeah. Well, people should check your work out, and we always appreciate having you. So, Professor Junaid Ahmad, thanks for joining us again on Flashpoints.
My pleasure. Thank you, Dennis. Bye-bye.
All right. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to talk about the battle, the latest battle, and it is a battle now to free solar power now. Free solar power now. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Ramsey Lewis, we lost him today. The great, great jazz, great Ramsey Lewis. We're going to miss you. And that beautiful, that was La Fleur by Ramsey Lewis. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And I think we have Harv Wasserman with us. Yes?
You there, Harv? Absolutely. Great to be
okay.
with you.
Okay. And is Tatanka there?
Yes, I'm here.
All right. I'm so excited. Tatanka, this is a tag team between you and Harv. You first. The battle is on now. There's every reason, I think you believe, there's every reason to support the implementation in the largest sense, in the biggest way, if you will, in California. The governor doesn't seem to agree. He's got some big roadblocks in the way. Take it away.
Yeah, well, it's up to the public now. Governor Newsom clearly plans to run for the presidency with the help of the utilities and the gas and electric corporations, but he's very responsive to public outcry. So we're going to be talking about the next meeting in Clovis, California, this Thursday, a CPUC meeting at 11 a.m. And if people can't get there in person, they can go by Zoom, and Harvey and I will talk about that. Really important, because he's already responded to the Air Resources Board after the last round of this, when he came out against rooftop solar and for the opening of the nuclear power plant in Diablo. And with all the hundreds and hundreds of phone calls he got, he, you know, made efforts to do some palliative things on the timeline for carbon zero and all that sort of stuff. So he does respond. It's up to us.
All right, that's the voice of Tatanka Bricka. He is really on the front line with Harvey Wasserman and a whole bunch of other people who strongly believe that solar is the answer and are deeply distressed by the fact that the governor has given the go-ahead for the revival and the bailout of massive, and what they feel very strongly about is endangering California, dangerous nuclear power. Tatanka, from your perspective, why is solar crucial now? What do people get at the bottom line, at the core? What do people get when they go with solar?
They get on rooftop solar, which is nearly 1.5 million people with it. They get their own local distributed energy, the cheapest possible way, the most democratic possible way. And the economics are already in. It's far more bang for the buck. It has really saved us in the local power issues recently. And the nuclear industry is just looking at the death of nuclear power and trying to reverse it. I want to remind our listeners that the only reason for the existence of nuclear energy is to provide fissile material for nuclear weapons. Yes. Electricity is just the excuse. Too cheap to meter, which is a total lie. And now we're saddled with all these things that really need to be decommissioned in times of climate change. So the earlier $2 trillion put up in the air and build without any really public fanfare as an upgrade on our nuclear capacity, that is a lie. It's a totally new technology, high tech that nobody has with AI, and it's starting a new level of arms race. So we can't forget that that's the reason for the existence of these things.
Harvey Wasserman, it is unimaginable that a politician who calls himself liberal, who wants to run for president on the liberal side of the spectrum, is going all the way for nuke energy. How did we explain this? What's the deal? Somebody own him or something?
Gavin Newsom wants the financial backing of the utility industry and the nuclear power industry and the coal, oil, nuke, and gas industry, which I call King Kong. He's supporting the extension of the two reactors at Diablo Canyon, which could blow up at any minute. We don't have evacuation plans for L.A. or for the Central Valley or for the Bay Area. and it's completely irresponsible. What people don't understand now, as Tatanka mentioned, we have well over a million homes, as many as 1.5 million homes in California with rooftop solar. This is a major piece of the utility supply puzzle in California now. And we have now had instances where the rooftop solar and the batteries that are individually owned have made the difference in keeping the grid up, not nuclear power. Nuclear power destabilizes our grid. So we have to do everything we can to shut Diablo. It's not a done deal. The legislature passed facilitating legislation, but there are many, many places along the way where we can prevent Diablo Canyon from continuing to operate. People should write me directly, solartopia@gmail.com. I'll send you a PDF of my People's Fifth Spiral of U.S. History, and we will figure out how to stop Diablo. But the first thing we have to do is to stop this tax on rooftop solar. And it's going to the CPUC. You can go, there's a website for the Solar Rights Alliance. It's solarrights.org, and find out the detail of how to call the CPUC. They're having a meeting at 11 a.m. Thursday morning, and then they're going to have another meeting. And, you know, the insanity, Dan, is almost incomprehensible. On the one hand, they want to hand $1.4 billion of public money to a nuclear plant that could blow up at any minute. And then on the other hand, they want to tax rooftop solar, which keeps our grid going, which is clean, safe, reliable, and far, far cheaper than nuclear power. So,
all right,
you know,
let me jump in here. That's Harvey Wasserman, Solartopia. Also joining us is Tatanka Birka. Tatanka, so you're sitting eye to eye with the dude. What is the breakdown? What do you tell him? You think it's hopeless, or you've got to have a little influence? What do you say?
I think it totally depends on hundreds and thousands of people responding. He is very sensitive. He's got his finger in the air, okay? The bigger picture is there's all this money coming in for a Biden's plan to get us to carbon zero by 2050. Far too late. We will all be toast by then. The Romero Institute and the Dolores Huerta Foundation partnering together, I work with a Circle of 100 that's a volunteer organization working with them. We have a series of bills, our latest bill on electrification of California just passed, 58-0 out of the assembly. We're part of a coalition of about 150 groups, including labor, environmental justice, environment, and interfaith groups. And what's building is a carbon zero for California, including regenerative agriculture, public banking, buildings, transportation, et cetera. Build this year, next year, and the following year with California carbon zero by 2030, which is what we need, and for California to lead the nation. This is happening, and this is the solution that we need, not the big plan coming out of Davos, which has been the 50-year plan of the oil and gas industry to control nuclear, to control solar, to control wind, and take their time in feathering it all together over the next 30 years. We don't have 30 years, Dennis. We are in the fight of our lives with climate change right now. It's a crisis.
Harv,
and we've got to protect rooftop solar. Rooftop solar is the key, because it allows people to own the energy source, and this is why PG&E and Southern California Edison and all the big utilities hate it, because it's the end of the utility industry if we can all have rooftop solar, and that's why the CPUC is lining up against it, and that's why we've got to call them and stop this tax on rooftop solar. Dennis, there are 70,000 people in California working in the solar and wind industries. There are 1,500 at Diablo. What are we talking about here? Ridiculous.
Wow. So it really is Tatanka, being owned by the last century, the corporate mind, and somehow the desire to keep splitting the atom and keeping the planet at risk. I mean, it's amazing we're having this discussion, Tatanka, when we see a war happening around Chernobyl and the largest nuclear reactor in Europe, and it sort of somehow doesn't sink into the liberal governor of California that it's not the right direction. It's frightening.
Yes, and I choose to believe that they see the end. They see their liabilities. They're fighting it tooth and nail. And I choose to believe that if the people really get organized around this, we are gonna win this. We have to decommission all the nukes in the world. Okay, that has to happen. And I think that it's so ironic. We got both Ron DeSantis and Governor Newsom look and see in Florida and in California, 8 out of 10 people support rooftop solar. DeSantis is playing politics by basically supporting rooftop solar. But what he says and what he does is two different things. Governor Newsom is playing politics by siding with the nuclear industry because he figures we have no place to go. Larger picture is that we need to do progressive.
I'm sorry, we're out of time now. I'm sorry to interrupt you, Tatanka. We're out of time now.
Okay.
Is there an address that you'd like to give out if people want to get more information, understand what your battle looks like?
There's a website, yes. solarrights.org, Solar Rights Alliance.
Yes.
You can support that. And you can write me directly, solartopia@gmail.com.
Okay.